Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet the latest winner of the Tulsa Library Trust's Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award, which this year goes to a poet, Billy Collins. The New York Times has called him the most popular poet in America, and that moniker would be hard to dispute. He's the author of 14 collections of his work, including the bestseller Aimless Love, The Trouble with Poetry, Questions About Angels, The Art of Drowning, and his latest collection, published this year, The Rain in Portugal. A line from one of his poems, which references the popular song The Rain in Spain. Collins' poems are known for mixing humor with keen insight, often profound insight, written in a conversational and direct way. In many ways, his work reflects our own subconscious or interior musings about how we perceive the world around us. Collins' poems are at times unabashedly sentimental in expressing love or regret, at other times quirky, along the lines of an observational comedian, but with a poet's sensibility to placement of word and line. Collins was the Poet Laureate of the United States from 2001 to 2003 and the Poet Laureate of the New York State from 2004 to 2006. He'll receive the Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award this weekend with a public presentation Saturday morning at 10:30 at Central Library, where he'll read from his work as well as sign books, and that is open to the public at Central Library. Billy Collins is my guest today. Billy Collins, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Congratulations on the Helmrich Award.
I was quite surprised to get it, and I'm glad to be getting it, though. So thank you.
Why don't you start off by reading a poem for us, would you?
Okay, well, let me read a poem for this new book called The Rain in Portugal. It's a poem called Dream Life, and it mentions a couple of allegorical characters. Fair warning there. Dream Life. Whenever I have a dream about poetry, which is not very often, considering how much I think about her, she appears as a seamstress who works in the window of a tailor shop in a sector of a provincial city laden with gray and heavy sky. I know the place so well, I could find the dimly lit shop without asking anyone for directions, though the streets are mostly empty, except when I saw a solitary man looking in the window of a butcher's, his hands in the pockets of his raincoat. Poetry works long hours and rarely speaks to the tailor as she mends to repair the fancy costumes of various allegorical characters who are told by thrift how little she charges. Maybe the ermine collar on the robe of excess has come loose, or a rip in the gown of abandon needs mending, and no questions will be asked about how that came to pass. A little bell over the door rings whenever a customer enters or leaves, but poetry is too busy thinking about her children as she replaces a gold button on the blazer of pride.
I like that, this idea of poetry being a seamstress that's working for the pride of the product.
Well, you know, this is a rather ancient form, allegory, which is really outdated, but it's interesting to kind of restore virtues like thrift or a cardinal sin like pride and personify or allegorize poetry as a just a kind of seamstress bent over her sewing machine in some corner of a rather depressing city. So, I mean, to me, if I look back at that poem, I don't remember actually the moment of its composition, but I can see that I was taking advantage of some of the imaginative freedom that writing poetry does offer. I mean, you can, you know, your poetry can be a water boy, or you can turn poetry into a cocker spaniel. I mean, there's a lot of leeway once you leave the precincts of, say, fiction or playwriting.
Of course, you hear this all the time. I'm sure that what people love is your poetry is so direct and it's open. But what I also love about it is you are using all the devices that poetry has given us over the years in a direct way.
Well, I'm saying I'm an English major, would be putting it mildly. I grew up on poetry. I studied it in college. I went to graduate school. I got a PhD in English, and then I immediately started teaching, and I have taught in the City University of New York for over 30 years. So basically teaching poetry. Not so much poetry writing. I didn't get into the creative workshop of poetry writing until later, much later in my life. So, yeah, I mean, things like allegory or the elegy or references to other poets, that's all part of my my makeup, and I do allow my reading to come into my poetry. You know, I didn't think you could do that when I was somewhat younger. I thought, you know, you did your reading on the side and then the composition of poetry detached from that. But I often reference what I'm reading or take off from a line in a poem, in not necessarily a poem, but could be a bit of nonfiction.
Take us back to your early days. There's a poem early in the collection titled Only Child. You know, there's a nice little bit about never wish for a sibling, boy or girl, center of the universe. I had the back of my parents' car all to myself. I could look out one window and slide over to the other windows without any quibbling over territorial rights. Do you think that affected your ability to see the world? Because one of the things about only children, you have to spend a lot of time entertaining yourself.
Yeah, well, that's because... That's your job, basically. But but children are basically self-entertaining creatures. I mean, if you put a bunch of them together, they will start playing randomly. And then as many people have pointed out, children get bored with play. And then one of the children, usually some leader of tomorrow, for better or worse, turns the play into game by introducing rules. And so instead of running around the backyard in circles, you have to run over and touch that tree and run back here, right? That's sort of the way children in groups get organized. If you're an only child, you spend a tremendous amount of time alone. And I think the imagination is developed in that quietude, in that solitude. I think people have the wrong idea about being an only child. They tend to think we are socially disabled in a way because we haven't been socialized properly. And we don't get along with others well. Well, that's true because we feel superior to most of them. That becomes a hindrance. Also, being an only child is really good preparation for being a poet because it does hone your observational skills. I mean, you do spend a lot of time, undisturbed time, just looking at things. And also, you know, poetry really doesn't require an interest in other people. That sounds brutal, but but I do mean it. But it doesn't require an interest in other people in the way that fiction or playwriting do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Poets are tend to be interested in themselves, quite frankly. And so being an only child is a tremendous, prepares you directly, if you needed any preparation, to be deeply interested in your own thoughts and feelings.
Were you writing poems as a child, or did you turn to poetry later?
Well, I was a little bit. I mean, I remember I had a very early memory of being, and I don't even know how old I was, maybe 8 or 9 or something, and asking my mother for something to write on as I was in the backseat of my parents' car, going from one window to the other without interruption. And we were driving, you know, I was born and raised in New York City, and we were driving up the East Side Highway with the East River right there. And there was a sailboat making its way up or down the river, I forget which. And I had apparently a literary reaction to this. I felt like writing something down. Now, I don't know what I wrote down, but I was quite insistent that my mother provide something to write on. But of course, if you flash forward, I mean, like most high school kids, I wrote a lot of poems that... that I hope have been, you know, destroyed or just blown into oblivion. Someone said that each of us is born with about 200 bad poems in us at birth, and high school is a great place to try to get rid of at least 100, 150 of them.
Now,
and I guess if you want to just, I mean, I just flash forward here. Only children like to talk about themselves, too. but I really didn't figure out how to write the way I write now until I was in my 30s, and therefore didn't get a book published until I was over 40. So I was a slow student.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was going to ask you about finding your voice. I would imagine having gone through, you know, undergraduate, graduate, and a professional school, that you probably didn't start out with this very direct sort of voice that we've come to expect from a Billy Collins poem. Did you try everything along the way?
Yeah, I tried all. I tried on all sorts of different hats and coats of other poets, and I think that's the way you develop through imitation, basically. I think this applies across the board. I mean, I don't think anyone would want to be a painter or a sculptor or a trombone player if they hadn't heard good tromboning and good and been stunned by paintings. And I think you basically your early work arises out of the desire to emulate your heroes and to be a little like them if possible. So I wrote, you know, very romantic poetry. I wrote kind of beatnik poetry, surrealistic poetry. I was really, really eager to be a poet, and it took me a long time to figure out this voice. And a lot of that had to do with giving certain parts of myself permission that I'd been suppressing. And basically, that was a sense of humor. I didn't think you could be funny in poems, and I was right. You weren't quite allowed to. And once I found poets who were being humorous without being, you know, clownish or just comic for its own sake, that really helped me a lot, find a tone of voice.
Were there bad reactions to the first time you sort of used a little humorous point in a poem, or was it a sort of a eureka breakthrough moment for you?
Oh, it was much more of a eureka. It was a eureka relief, anyway, that because it felt quite natural to be ironic or amusing in a poem, you know, to be amused maybe even by the poem as you're writing it, to take things lightly for a while before you take something seriously. So it was a form of verbal play, and that opened all sorts of pleasures, the pleasure of play that I didn't really, I was taking poetry much too seriously. I mean, I do take it quite seriously now, especially having received this prize. I better take it seriously. It carries an obligation. But I really wasn't enjoying writing poetry. I did it dutifully. I did it kind of passionately and desperately in my eagerness to be a poet. But suddenly I could play with language, and that was a real opening.
What was the reactions of the first people that read this voice that you had found?
Well, they were good. I really never showed my poems around very much. I never took a workshop. But I did have a couple of very important editors, namely Miller Williams, who published my first real book. And he identified in the manuscript I sent him the poems. He set aside a handful of the poems I sent him, and they were poems that were using irony better than the other ones, that had a kind of lighter touch to them. And he promised me that he would publish a book, which would be my very first book, if I could write more poems that had that tone, that touch. He didn't even tell me what was in there. He just said, write more poems like these poems, and don't write poems like the other poems. It was he put a paperclip around the good ones. It was like getting a master's of fine arts. It was, paperclip was better than 3 years of getting an MFA.
My guest today is Billy Collins, a poet, a former U.S. poet laureate, and winner of this year's Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award. The public presentation will take place Saturday morning at 10:30 at Central Library, and he's our guest on Studio Tulsa. He's been a guest several times and visited Tulsa a number of times over the years, and a wonderful poet. As you found that voice, and one of the things about reading your poetry is that voice to readers sounds like you. And I'm sure it's not exactly you, but is it pretty close to you? Or how would you describe that voice?
Well, it's better than me. it's an improvement. It's a refinement. I don't know. If you can do the voice consistently, a voice, basically that means you have a persona. You know, that's sort of the literary term for this tone of voice. And if you can produce that voice consistently over the years, it clearly is part of you. I mean, you couldn't just kind of put it on every time. So I would say, like, if there were two Venn diagrams, me and my persona, we would overlap very heavily, but not completely, because he's just a he's an idealization of who I'd like to be, really. I mean, he's transcended a lot of the concerns that are plague my life, like having a job and paying bills and taking out the garbage. He has nothing to do with any of that. He looks out the window. goes back to bed. You know, he doesn't have any real responsibilities. And of course, being an only child, he has very few other people involved in his world. He's a very solitary person.
He has time to look at the immutable laws concerning governing bodies in motion and bodies at rest that a cat picked up will never stay in the place where you choose to set it down. I love that line.
Well, a lot of cat lovers really, and I'm not, I'm a dog lover first, but I'm kind of between dogs now, and there are two cats wandering around this house that are our cats, really. But it's very true. I mean, if you put a cat down, even if you find what you think is the most comfortable place in the house, put it down on some easy chair or whatever, they like finding their spots. And that, I think, is a big part of their day. Because often you look around, you find them, and they found this, like a patch of sunlight on this really soft throw or something like that. And it's better than any place you could have found for them. So I think it's better to leave that to the cat.
Now, let me ask you about writing a cat poem, a poem that it's ostensibly about a cat, although a lot of times that cat poem is really telling a bigger story. Was there any trepidation about saying, you know, I'm going to write a poem about a cat?
Well, it is alien territory for me. I mean, I have a lot of poems about dogs.
Yes, you do.
And, particularly about this one dog I had for years, Janine, a little Australian Shepherd mix. And after we lost her, I just haven't replaced her. And I felt like I was trespassing in a way. I know there are, you know, it's sort of like Republican and Democrat or Ford and Chevy or cat or dog. I mean, they're usually kind of people you can drive a wedge between the population, whether they fall on the cat side or the dog side. And then we have to make room for the people who keep birds and stuff like that. But basically, I didn't feel particularly equipped, but I moved ahead anyway.
One of the things there's in the new collection, The Rain in Portugal, there's a poem called Bags of Time. And it strikes me as this is a device you'll use quite often. And sometimes it's just a glance, at least from the persona side of maybe an observation that becomes the basis of a poem later. And in this one, it's about an innkeeper who said this particular phrase, you have bags of time, and then you just sort of riff on it. Can you maybe talk about, as you go through your life, are you consciously looking for these things, or do they come up in your memory, or how does that process work for you? Because I think if you were actually thinking about, oh, hey, that will make a great poem, that it wouldn't make a great poem.
Yeah. No, I think it's a little like snagging a burr on your pant leg or something. Some little expression that, like this guy saying, "You've got bags of time." I'd never heard that before. I'd heard oodles of time and other expressions, but maybe this is where the only child comes in. I mean, if you have time to think about these things, something else will occur. But often it's a line from, you know, I could be reading a book on World War I or a book on space travel, and often there'll be a sentence that stops me, and the sentence will either be the epigraph to the poem or it will be the starting point. And I can't approach a poem unless I have the beginning. You know, all of my poems are written beginning, middle, and end. I never, you know, it's... The pen moves through the poem kind of usually in one sitting. It's not constructed like you would put model trains together, right? Moving cars around and changing parts. It's more like a through line, a kind of continuous chain of associations or thoughts that are desperately trying to find an ending for themselves.
Right.
And but you need that bags of time beginning to get it in motion.
Now, you say it's a sort of a through line, but one of the things I've read that you've said in other interviews is, you know, you're really much a line crafter. This is not prose being turned into poetry. You're crafting lines.
Yeah, well, I think that's essential to poetry, and you know, when you're reading, when I'm reading a prose, I mean, the recently read Ann Padgett's new book, Commonwealth, and she's one of the writers you can read for sentences, you know, and I, every page or so, I'd find a sentence that was just a really, really good sentence that I'd reread. Well, in poems, there are lots of local delights, but one of the local delights, in addition to maybe seeing a part of a poem as a sentence, are individual lines, because that's the way poems are constructed. So I'm always trying to move from one good line to the other, and there is a general through line that's moving me through the whole body of the poem, because I've got a chain of thoughts that's work that's moving me forward. But at the same time, I'm trying to build these lines like a carpenter, you might say, that there's a kind of a sense of craft as each line is written and seem sufficient as a line of poetry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as one of the things I was also reading about, you said at one point, it says, you know, when I'm writing a poem, I'm writing to be in one person's head, which is kind of, there's a little bit of irony there, because a lot of times you're speaking before, I mean, you're one of the few poets that can fill a house to hear you read your poems.
Well, that is a bit of an irony there, because I'm not, I mean, the voice I'm using that you referred to before is not a broadcasting voice. I mean, it's not a voice that is writing in capital letters, yelling at you. I try to make it an intimate voice that is talking to one person. But then that one person, luckily, at times seems to multiply into hundreds of people, you know, who's sitting in an auditorium. But I really enjoy giving readings, and I don't mind even doing all the travel that gets me from one place to another, but it has really nothing to do with my compositional process. I mean, I'm very quiet, right? I'm thinking of another quiet person who is not sitting in an auditorium, but sitting at a chair at home or sitting on a porch or in a coffee house or something.
That's interesting.
You're right. I try to have a very quiet person-to-person voice. And I do think, I mean, just to speak more generally for a second, that one of the things that poetry offers is that kind of intimacy. I don't want to get into contemporary politics, but we've always been inundated by public language. And over the past couple of years in America, we have been really saturated with public language, with the rhetoric of campaigning, for example. And we never get a sense that we are being spoken to as an individual. And it's even, you know, in a novel, when I'm reading a novel, I'm so conscious that, you know, hundreds of other people, maybe thousands, have read this novel. When I'm reading a really good poem, I feel that this poet, let's say Mary Oliver, I feel that she's speaking to me, almost whispering to me, just the two of us somewhere. And I think that intimacy, that personal touch, for lack of a better word, is something that only poetry can convey.
You know, it's funny, when I read a lot of your work, I get a sense that you are speaking to me, and also,
I am, Rich. That's you.
Thank you.
But
that's the other thing I get the sense of, that you're sitting at your desk, and your desk has a window. And
right.
I really have that strong sense in reading it. Is that part of that persona that you've built over the years?
Yeah, and he's a very domestic guy. He, even though I was born and raised in New York City and still spend some time there, he's rarely a city guy. He's if he's looking at a lawn or a palm tree or or even a cow sometimes. But he's a domestic, quiet character who is quite taken with his own thought process and who is snooping around for making these little observations. It's partially true. Sometimes I'm writing a poem like that in an airplane, but his location is usually domestic.
Yeah. Would you finish by reading one more poem for us?
Sure thing. Well, here's a poem called Meditation. And it is from the new book, The Rain and Poor Journal. Meditation. I was sitting cross-legged one morning in our sunny new meditation room, wondering if it would be okay to invite our out-of-town guests to Frank's dinner party next week, when it occurred to me that I wasn't really meditating at all. In fact, I had never meditated in our sunny new meditation room. I had just sat cross-legged now and then for 15 or 20 minutes, worrying about one thing or another, how the world will end, or what to get Alice for her birthday. It would make more sense to rename the meditation room our new exercise room, and to replace all the candles, incense holders, and little statues with two 10-pound hand weights and a towel in case I broke a sweat. Then I pictured the new room with nothing in it but a folded white towel and a pair of numbered hand weights, an image of such simplicity that the sustaining of it, as I sat cross-legged under a tall window, my palms open weightlessly on my bare knees, made me wonder if I wasn't actually meditating for a moment then and there in our former meditation room, where the sun seemed to be brightening as it suffused with light the grain in the planks of that room's gleaming floor.
That's nice. That's a nice poem. The name of the new collection is The Rain in Portugal. And Billy Collins, congratulations again on winning the Peggy Helmrich Distinguished Author Award. I hope a lot of people come out Saturday morning to hear you. Billy Collins, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Rich.
Poet Billy Collins is the winner of this year's Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award. The former U.S. Poet Laureate will receive the award this weekend at the Central Library. There'll be a public presentation Saturday morning at 10:30. He'll be reading from his work and signing books. That takes place at Central Library, and you can learn more at tulsalibrary.org. His latest collection of poetry is titled The Rain in Portugal. It's published by Random House. For that Studio Tulsa for today, our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.